Usually when we talk about building massive critical infrastructure, like think of a towering skyscraper or, a suspension bridge carrying thousands of cars a day.
Right, the stuff we rely on every single day.
Exactly. There is this expectation of absolute, just flawless precision. You look at those massive steel beams being welded together and you kind of just assume the engineering behind it is a completely settled science.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely prefer to view our physical world that way, right?
Yeah.
Predictable, measurable, completely safe. We want it to be a simple binary, like it holds or it breaks.
Right, you figure somebody somewhere ran a calculation and knows down to the decimal point exactly how much weight that specific joint can hold before it snaps. But the reality is a bit messier.
Oh, absolutely. Beneath the surface of that steel, you are looking at a landscape that is incredibly dynamic. The strength of the materials we use isn't just a simple matter of what they're made of.
Which is crazy to think about.
It really is. It actually comes down to how those raw ingredients physically arrange themselves in a fraction of a second while rapidly cooling down from a liquid state.
Which is why today we are taking a fascinating journey into the microscopic architecture of the world around you. Welcome to the deep dive. We're looking at a classic 1988 breakthrough out of Cambridge University.
Yeah, the paper by Sugden and Padacia, a really foundational piece of metallurgical research.
Right. And these two researchers, A.A.B. Sugden and H.K.D.H. Padacia, essentially proved that everything the industry thought it knew about predicting steel strength was, well, missing half the picture.
They fundamentally challenged the status quo. Prior to their work, engineers were trying to predict the strength of a weld by looking almost entirely at the chemical recipe.
Just the ingredients.
Exactly. But Sugden and Badeshia demonstrated that if you really want to know how much load a piece of steel can take, you have to look past the chemistry and zoom way in on the microscopic geometry of the metal itself.
Okay, let's unpack this. Over the next few minutes, we are going to explore the fatal flaws of those old measurement systems, take a microscopic journey into the rapidly cooling phases of a liquid weld, and reveal a groundbreaking mathematical model that changed our understanding of material strength.
It's a great journey. But, before we get to the microscopic architecture, we need to understand the baseline.
Right, like prior to this 1988 paper, how were engineers actually trying to predict if a weld was going to hold?
Well, historically, the standard practice was to express the weld metal's strength simply as a function of its alloying elements. It was a purely chemical view based on simple linear regression analysis.
So just math based on the periodic table, essentially.
Pretty much, you would have an equation where the yield stress, which is the amount of force the steel can take before it permanently bends,
Right.
that yield stress equals a base constant plus a certain amount of strength for the manganese you added, plus the strength from the silicon, the carbon, and so on.
I have to admit, I'm going to push back on why that is considered a problem. Like, if I know exactly what chemical elements are in the vat of steel, shouldn't I know exactly how strong the resulting steel is?
You would think so.
Yeah. I mean, if it's the exact same chemical recipe, the output should be identical, shouldn't it?
The problem is that a chemical recipe alone is missing the actual instructions for how to cook it. The issue with those old regression models is that they were highly specific to the one single batch of data they were originally tested on.
Oh, so they weren't universal.
Not at all. The coefficients, the specific numbers a scientist assigned to how much strength 1% of manganese added, those were wildly inconsistent depending on who did the math.
Well, everyone had a different formula.
Exactly. The moment you tried to use those chemical equations on a new welding process or, say, a different thickness of steel, the predictions just fell apart.
So it's kind of like baking a cake. If I give you a list detailing the exact amounts of flour, sugar, and eggs I used, that chemistry doesn't actually tell you if the cake is going to be light and fluffy or as dense as a brick.
That is a perfect analogy.
Because the oven temperature, how long I baked it, whether I let it cool on the counter or threw it in the fridge, that thermal history completely changes the final physical product, even though the chemical ingredients are identical down to the gram.
Yeah, and the source material explicitly highlights that exact phenomenon. The authors point out a glaring blind spot in the chemistry-only approach, which is post-weld heat treatments.
Wait, what does that mean in practice?
Well, in the field, you can take a finished, cooled weld, heat it back up with a torch, let it cool down again, and you significantly alter its overall strength.
Oh, wow. And you haven't added or removed a single atom of manganese or silicon.
Exactly. You haven't changed the chemistry at all.
You've just given it a new thermal history. which means the physical strength of the steel must be a function of something else. I mean, it has to be the physical shapes the metal forms as it cools down, what you'd call the microstructure.
That is the core realization. Almost every variable in the welding process, how hot the arc is, the temperature of the surrounding air, the geometry of the joint.
All the environmental stuff.
Right. All of that ultimately manifests by altering the microscopic structure of the steel.
Which brings us back to the texture of our cake. If the chemistry alone is leading engineers astray, we need to zoom in and look at the microscopic architecture that forms when a pool of liquid steel weld cools down and solidifies.
Let's do it. Let's go down to the microscopic level.
Yeah, what actually happens in that glowing pool of liquid metal?
So let's track the cooling process. It starts at the fusion boundary. That's the outer edge where the liquid weld is physically touching the cold, solid parent plate.
Okay, so the edges are touching cold metal.
Right. And the temperature drops so rapidly here that the liquid atoms freeze into place almost instantly. They attach themselves to the existing crystal structure of the solid steel.
Is that what they call epitaxial growth?
Yes, exactly. And as the heat flows outward into the cold plate, the liquid metal solidifies into these long cellular grains that point toward the center of the weld.
I'm picturing like frost rapidly spreading across a freezing window pane, growing inward from the edges.
That is a really great way to visualize it. Now, as the metal continues to cool, it hits a critical thermal threshold.
A tipping point.
Yeah, a specific temperature drop where the atomic structure of the solid steel is forced to completely reorganize itself. In metallurgy, this is where the primary microstructure is born.
Okay.
And in our steel weld, this structure forms in three very distinct morphological phases.
Three different microscopic shapes. Okay, walk us through them. What's the first one?
First, we have allotriomorphic ferrite. This is the very first shape to form as the metal crosses that temperature threshold.
Allotriomorphic ferrite. Got it. What does it look like?
It nucleates at the boundaries of those long grains we just talked about. It spreads rapidly, creating a smooth, nearly uniform layer hugging the walls of the grain.
Okay, so shape number one is basically smooth layers coating the boundaries. What happens as it keeps cooling?
Second, you get Widmansteden ferrite.
Widmansteden.
Yeah, and this shape also starts at the grain boundaries, but instead of smoothing out along the wall, it grows aggressively inward. It forms thin, parallel, wedge-shaped plates that thrust directly into the center of the grain.
Okay, so we have smooth walls and now wedge-shaped plates, like tiny microscopic daggers shooting inward.
That's a good image. And while those daggers are forming, the third phase emerges, which is acicular ferrite.
Acicular ferrite? How is this one different?
Unlike the first two, this one doesn't start at the outer boundaries. It nucleates internally, right in the middle of the grain. It consists of a chaotic, interlocking array of microscopic plates.
So it's a mess in the middle.
Basically. If you look at it under an electron microscope, it resembles a dense, disorganized basket weave. And the paper notes something vital about this specific shape.
What's that?
Historically, this basket weave acicular ferrite is associated with optimum high strength and high toughness in a weld.
Okay, let's pause here, because if you're listening and trying to picture this in your head, we don't want to get lost in the metallurgical terms. We essentially have three main shapes dictating the landscape.
Right, just three main structures to keep in mind.
The smooth walls of the allotriomorphic ferrite, the sharp inward-pointing wedges of the Widmansteden ferrite, and the chaotic basket weave of the acicular ferrite in the center. But wait, is there anything else hiding in there?
There are a few other components the authors refer to as microphases. These include things like martensite, degenerate perlite, and retained austenite.
Those sound like they could be important. Why are we setting them aside and focusing just on the first three?
It really just comes down to sheer volume. Those microphases are present, but they make up only 1 to 3% of the total weld microstructure.
Oh, so they're tiny.
Exactly. The vast, overwhelming majority of the weld consists of those first three shapes. They are the true architects of the steel's primary framework.
Okay, so Sugden and Padacia have identified the shapes, but their goal was to build a mathematical model to replace those flawed chemistry-only equations we talked about earlier. How do you turn a visual description of microscopic wedges and basket weaves into a reliable math equation?
What's fascinating here is how they structured their core hypothesis. They proposed that the total yield strength of the weld metal could be factorized.
Factorized, meaning what exactly?
Meaning the overall strength isn't just one messy number.
It can be cleanly broken down into three distinct components added together.
Like an itemized receipt for the steel strength. Okay, so component one is probably the base material, right? The intrinsic strength of pure plain iron without anything added.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just the iron.
And component two would be the solid solution strengthening, that's the chemical cocktail part, right? Where dissolved elements like manganese distort the atomic lattice and make the metal harder to bend.
Correct. They didn't throw out the chemistry entirely, they just reduced it to its proper proportion.
Yeah.
And that leaves component three.
The geometry.
Yes. This is where they finally account for the physical geometry. They mathematically define this third component as the sum of the inherent strengths of each of our three shapes. The smooth walls, the wedges, and the basket weave.
Added together.
Right. Multiplied by how much physical space they take up in the weld, which we call their volume fraction.
But this is where the theoretical physics hits a brick wall for me. How do you actually measure the individual strength of a microscopic wedge-shaped plate of steel that is buried inside a larger piece of metal?
It sounds impossible, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can't exactly grab a single microscopic wedge with tiny tweezers, hook it up to a machine, and pull it apart to see when it breaks.
No, you can't isolate them physically, which is why their methodology relies on isolating them mathematically.
Okay, how did they do that?
They fabricated three separate multi-pass welds using low-carbon manganese steel on thick steel plates. They used standard manual arc welding at a very controlled speed. But they changed one key variable across the three welds.
What did they change?
They used specially developed electrodes to manipulate the amount of carbon in each batch.
Because changing the carbon alters how the metal cools, which changes the ratio of our three microscopic shapes.
You've got it.
So by increasing the carbon, they forced the weld to grow more of that basket weave acicular ferrite while shrinking the amount of smooth walls and wedges. They essentially created three identical-looking steel blocks that had completely different internal geometric layouts.
Exactly. And from there, they needed to measure the total strength of each block. They used a Vickers indenter, which presses a microscopic diamond pyramid into the polished surface of the metal using a precise 10-kilogram weight.
Just denting the steel to see how hard it is?
Right. By measuring the exact dimensions of the tiny indentation left behind, they determine the hardness of the metal. And for a rigid plastic material like steel, you can mathematically convert that hardness directly into yield stress.
Really? It's just a direct conversion?
Pretty much. The yield stress is roughly equal to the Vickers hardness divided by 3.
Okay, so they know the total strength of the weld, and by looking through a microscope and counting thousands of points on a grid, they know the exact volume fractions of the shapes inside.
Yes.
But they still don't know the individual strength of the specific shapes. I mean, one equation with three unknown variables can't be solved.
Which is why they expanded the board. They didn't just rely on their three experimental welds. To make sure their model was mathematically bulletproof, they pulled highly detailed metallurgical data from 62 other welds from various published sources.
Wow, 62 more.
Yeah, covering different welding processes and heat inputs. That gave them a massive data set of 65 different welds.
Oh, I see the genius in this. It's like a massive system of algebraic equations. Imagine you go to a bakery 65 different times, buying different random combinations of croissants, muffins, and scones. The cashier only ever hands you the final total bill.
Right, you don't know the individual prices.
But because you have 65 different receipts with different combinations, you can use linear regression to calculate exactly how much each individual pastry costs. They use 65 different welds to mathematically deduce the isolated strength of the microscopic shapes.
That is exactly how the linear regression works here. They plugged in the known totals, subtracted the baseline iron and the chemical elements, and isolated the physical structures.
And it worked.
It did. The calculations revealed very specific intrinsic yield strength values for each microstructural component. Let's look at the numbers. The smooth, wall-hugging, allotriomorphic ferrite contributed a meager 27 megapascals to the overall strength.
27 megapascals? That's barely stronger than the baseline pure iron itself. It's doing almost nothing to hold the building up.
Right. Then we look at the acicular ferrite, that intricate, disorganized basket weave structure sitting inside the grain. That shape contributed a massive 402 megapascals.
Wow. We jumped from 27 to 402. That basket weave is doing some serious heavy lifting.
But then we look at the Widmann-Stettin ferrite, those displacive wedge-shaped daggers. The regression proved they topped the chart at an incredible 486 megapascals.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Wait a minute. Earlier, you explicitly pointed out that the source paper noted the basket-weave acicular ferret was historically prized by engineers for providing the optimum high strength and toughness.
I did say that, yeah.
That's the shape they wanted to maximize. But the math just proved that the Widman-Stettin wedges are actually stronger, 486 to 402. Why the contradiction? If the wedges are mathematically stronger, why were engineers aiming for the basket weave?
It all comes down to the physical mechanisms of how those specific shapes are born during the cooling process. Widman-Stettin ferret grows by a process called a displacive transformation mechanism.
Displacive transformation? What does that mean physically?
When most metals cool, the atoms slowly diffuse, migrating one by one to form a new crystal lattice. But in a displacive transformation, a whole region of the atomic lattice suddenly shifts and shears into its new wedge shape all at once.
Like a tiny, violent, microscopic earthquake inside the steel.
Yes. And that violent displacive growth leaves the resulting wedge with a significantly higher dislocation density.
Dislocation density. Can you translate the physics of that for us?
Here. Think of it as intense internal tension. The atomic structure of that wedge is left heavily distorted, packed with microscopic irregularities and tangled atomic planes.
Okay, so it's all tangled up inside.
Right. When you apply massive force to a steel beam later, say, the weight of a skyscraper, you are trying to force planes of atoms to slide past one another. But in the Widman-Stettin wedge, those internal dislocations tangle up and act as a massive barrier to any further deformation.
Ah, I get it. It makes the material vastly stronger and more resistant to bending. It's like trying to forcefully push your way through a crowded room where everyone is already bumping into each other and gridlocked, as opposed to trying to run down an empty hallway. The existing internal tension makes it incredibly difficult to force any further movement. It's essentially microscopic, pre-stressed concrete.
That's a brilliant way to put it.
Yeah.
And there's a secondary mechanism at play, too. The source notes that Widman-Stettin ferret laths typically have tiny carbides aligned along their edges.
Carbides acting like what, exactly?
They act like microscopic rebar, providing even more structural reinforcement to those wedges. That is why they score a 486 on the strength chart.
This is mind-blowing. By breaking down the geometry of the microscopic shapes, we uncover the hidden mechanical physics of why a steel beam holds weight. But, I have to bring us back to the real world for a second.
Okay, sure.
This model, this beautiful factorization equation where everything adds up perfectly, sounds amazing for a pristine single pass of a welder's torch in a Cambridge laboratory. But real world construction is incredibly messy.
It is very messy.
Building a suspension bridge involves multi-pass welding. You are laying down bead after bead of liquid metal, sometimes dozens of layers deep, constantly blasting the underlying metal with extreme heat. Doesn't that totally ruin the pristine microscopic geometry we just calculated?
It absolutely alters it. And Sugden and Padacia knew their model had to survive multi-pass welding to be useful.
So what did they do?
They meticulously analyzed the cross-sections of their multi-pass welds. They superimposed a grid of 6,600 individual squares over the microscopic imagery and conducted a painstaking aerial analysis.
6,600 squares? That's a lot of counting. What did they find?
They found that a staggering 54% of the weld metal had been reheated by subsequent welding passes.
Over half the weld was essentially cooked twice. The thermal history is totally scrambled.
And as you pointed out with the baking analogy earlier, reheating changes the microstructure considerably. The source explicitly states that there is no mathematical model currently capable of predicting the exact microscopic geometry of those chaotic reheated regions.
Really? None at all?
The overlapping thermal cycles are simply too complex to map.
So doesn't the whole model fall apart? I mean, if 54% of the weld is an unpredictable twice-baked mess, how can an engineer rely on this equation to ensure a skyscraper won't collapse?
They can rely on it because of a brilliant statistical realization. The researchers didn't just test the overall weld. They mapped the hardness of both the pristine, primary as-welded regions and the messy reheated regions separately.
Okay.
And they found a near-perfect correlation between the two.
Mm.
Even though the reheated regions structurally changed, their final hardness directly reflected the original hardability of the primary microstructure they started out as.
Oh, I see. So if the primary structure was incredibly strong, you know, because the initial cooling created lots of high-tension Widman-Stettin wedges or basket-weave ferret, mm-hmm. the reheated, cooked-twice version of that specific structure would also be proportionally strong.
Exactly.
The DNA of its strength carries over.
They plotted it on a graph and found a correlation coefficient of 0.90.
That's huge.
In material science, that is an incredibly strong, undeniable relationship. It means that even in the messy reality of multi-pass welding on a construction site, if you can mathematically predict the strength of the primary microstructure using their factorization model, you can confidently predict the overall behavior of the entire weld. The model scales from the microscope to the real world.
That is incredible. So, to synthesize this journey, we started with a flawed, chemistry-only recipe book that left engineers guessing with inconsistent coefficients.
Right, the old linear regression.
We zoomed in past the chemical elements and looked at the rapid, chaotic cooling of liquid steel. We mapped out the microscopic architecture, the smooth boundary walls, the intricate basket weaves, and those high-tension dagger-like wedges of Widman, Stettin, Ferret, packed with microscopic rebar.
The structural heavy lifters.
Yeah, and through some brilliant algebra across 65 different welds, we uncovered a mathematical model that proves we can predict the strength of a massive piece of critical infrastructure simply by understanding the specific volume of microscopic shapes hidden inside it.
It really is a triumph of material science, proving that the physical arrangement of matter is just as important as the matter itself. But, you know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, there is one lingering caveat buried in the paper that I find deeply compelling.
Oh, what did they leave us with?
Well, the researchers noted that while their model was highly successful and the linear regression was incredibly accurate, there were a few instances of higher strength welds where the actual measured strength noticeably exceeded what the equation predicted.
Meaning there was extra strength coming from somewhere else.
Yes. They hypothesized that the ultimate limit to the accuracy of their mathematical model might actually lie within those tiny microphases, the martensite and degenerate perlite.
Wait, you mean that tiny 1-3% of the weld that we explicitly decided to ignore at the very beginning because it was supposedly too small to matter?
Yes, exactly that 1%. While the high-tension wedges and basket woos are clearly the primary heavy lifters holding the steel together, those hidden microphases packed tightly inside the structure might be contributing a highly unpredictable amount of strength that we haven't fully mapped out yet.
Wow.
The model is brilliant, but nature is still hiding a few secrets in the microscopic margins.
That is such a profound thought to end on. It leaves you wondering whether we are talking about the metallurgy of a suspension bridge, writing complex software code, or, I don't know, even analyzing human behavior in a massive economy. How often is the final, absolute limit of our predictive power hidden right there in the 1% we casually assumed was just too small to matter?
It's definitely something to think about.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay insanely curious, and we'll see you next time.